I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. This past weekend marked the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights March in Selma, Alabama, when activists were pressing for voting rights and faced violence that shocked the nation. It became known as Bloody Sunday. President Obama spoke in Selma on Saturday and said this.
The Voting Rights Act was one of the crowning achievements of our democracy, the result of Republican and Democratic efforts. President Reagan signed its renewal when he was in office. President George W. Bush signed its renewal when he was in office. 100 members of Congress have come here today to honor people who are willing to die for the right to protect it. If we want to honor this day, let that 100 go back to Washington and gather 400 more and together pledge to make it their mission to restore that law this year. That's how we honor those on this bridge.
Our guest, Senator Chris Coons, Democrat from Delaware, was in Selma along with other members of Congress. He brought with him a copy of the Voting Rights Amendment Act, looking for a Republican co-sponsor. We asked him to join us on Radio Times. And Senator Coons, nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Marty. Great to be with you.
Any Republicans in Selma interested in co-sponsoring your bill?
So far, we've not had any great luck with the Republicans with whom I've spoken. But a number of Republican senators have shared with me just how deeply they were affected by the weekend. And I think they are open to a meaningful conversation about voting rights and about how we might restore the Voting Rights Act from the damage done to it by the Shelby County decision by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, as you well know, Marty, invalidated a formula that is roughly 50 years old that was used to subject certain states to preclearance requirements based on their history of abuses of the voting rights of minorities. And what we've worked towards is a modernized formula, one that would subject those states and municipalities and counties to preclearance based on their current bad acts on violations of the Voting Rights Act over the last 5 years. It's my hope that working with Congressman John Lewis, working with Senator Pat Leahy, that we can find Republicans in the Senate. There is a Republican in the House, Congressman Sensenbrenner, who is an original co-sponsor in this Congress and was in the last Congress, and there's roughly a dozen Republican House members. But so far, we've been very disappointed in the Senate.
The Supreme Court, including Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, looking at the Voting Rights Act, said that the data really was outdated. It was from the 1960s, 1970s. Do you agree that that the Voting Rights Act needed to be updated to deal with today's conditions?
Well, I do think that the Voting Rights Act deserves to be updated. There are dozens of states across the country where there have been Voting Rights Act violations in recent years. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court rendered a decision in Shelby County that didn't take into account the sharp partisan divisions in the current Congress, the difficulty getting an historic law like the Voting Rights Act revised and amended and made more current in this political setting. I was pleased to see this past weekend that President George W. Bush and former First Lady Laura Bush joined President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama on the stage in Selma. The passage that you just played, that piece from the president's really powerful speech, was in some ways, I think, made more powerful by having President Bush standing next to him on the stage applauding the idea that we should be continuing to strengthen, continuing to sustain the Voting Rights Act. This march in Selma last weekend, Marty, wasn't just a commemoration of the sacrifice made 50 years ago. It was a call to action for all of us, Democrats and Republicans, to ensure that the fundamental civil right of voting rights is real and is protected today.
Is this a Southern issue? Is this a national issue? There have been efforts in a number of states to put in voter ID tests and similar kinds of requirements for people wanting to vote.
That's right, Marty. There have been violations of voting rights all across the country in recent years. while in the 1960s, the most egregious oppression, the most egregious violations of voting rights were concentrated heavily in the South and on a racial basis, in recent years there have been voting rights violations all over the country in ways that affect linguistic minorities, racial minorities, religious minorities. And I think it is appropriate for us to update the Voting Rights Act so that it provides a preclearance protection in all communities across the country.
But are you saying that things like voter ID in Pennsylvania that sort of considered this for a while and decided against it, but the idea of a voter ID, that that's a violation of the right to vote?
Well, one of the things we've debated, including in the Voting Rights Amendments Act, is so-called known practices, which are a series of things that jurisdictions do that often have a disparate impact. It is difficult to prove before the fact that a certain change in voting practices is done with discriminatory intent. Historically, in order to prove that a Voting Rights Act violation has occurred, you have to, after several cycles, after several elections, demonstrate that it has had a disparate impact, that it has disproportionately deprived a certain population or group of their right to vote. Those are very tough cases to bring and prove. Despite how hard they are, how expensive they are to bring and prove, there have been cases proven across the country in recent years. So to your basic question there, Marty, it's not just a Southern problem. Mm. We had a hearing in the Judiciary Committee in the last Congress on voter ID laws, and we're not able to get evidence, despite repeated efforts by Republican champions of voter ID laws, that there was any significant problem with voter fraud across the country, that we've got folks, you know, voting 3 and 4 and 5 times, or we've got illegal aliens voting, and that voter ID is serving some positive purpose to ensure that people aren't voting who have no right to vote. Instead, what we heard was a great deal of evidence that voter ID laws actually discourage or prevent students and seniors from voting, that it makes it more difficult for those who don't have driver's licenses, for example, or who live in other states, for example, to come and vote.
I'm curious about why what you think has changed, because back in 2006, the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized by huge majorities in Congress, signed by President Bush. What's different today?
I think what's different today, sadly, is a more sharply partisan atmosphere in the Congress. We are having difficulty coming to agreement on a wide range of basic issues, whether it's an extension to Medicare or dealing with Social Security disability or fixing our roads and bridges. The Highway Trust Fund is about to run out of money, and we do not have a bipartisan path forward for how to pay for it. In the education area, they are struggling in the Health and Education Committee right now to find a bipartisan path towards reauthorizing the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. There is a real breakdown in an ability and a willingness to work across the aisle. And I think the Voting Rights Act, something that for a long time was championed by Republicans, something that was only passed back in 1965 in the first instance because Republican Senator Everett Dirksen was one of the leaders of the effort to get it passed, that historic bipartisanship has frayed.
And that's Senator Chris Coons, a Democrat from Delaware. He was in Selma, Alabama over the weekend there for a number of different reasons, including looking for a sponsor for his voting rights legislation. And we are interested in your comments. You can join us by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times about what we are talking about in this segment of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Senator Coons, I do want to play another clip from President Obama's speech on Saturday. He was there in Selma marking the 50th anniversary of that of Bloody Sunday, as it came to be known. And I just want to play another segment of the speech, and let's give it a listen.
What's our excuse today for not voting? How do we so casually discard the right for which so many fought? How do we so fully give away our power, our voice in shaping America's future? Why are we pointing to somebody else when we could take the time just to go to the polling places?
What I found so interesting is that while the president was talking about the importance of passing voting rights legislation, he did call out the American people for their apathy about voting. How do you understand that?
Well, I thought that balance, that taking both sides of the issue and addressing them head on, was part of what made President Obama's speech in Selma this past weekend so powerful. He wasn't speaking as a partisan. He wasn't speaking as solely as a Democrat. He was speaking as someone who was concerned about voting and concerned about continuing to make real the legacy of the struggle and sacrifice of Selma of 50 years ago. So he did address and challenge members of Congress to step up and fix the Voting Rights Act in the ways we've just discussed. But he also raised what has often been a Republican criticism. Why do we need to address the law when there are millions of Americans no one is seeking to suppress their vote who just choose not to come out and vote? So I think it was an important balance in the president's speech, a call for personal responsibility, a call for initiative to come out and vote that gave it balance.
But why do you think people don't vote?
I think, sadly, it is exactly the dysfunction, the partisanship, the inability to get things passed here that discourages many from thinking that their vote will make a difference. What I struggle with is that in the last few cycles, particularly in 2010 and 2014, more members have been elected who come here to prevent things from happening. More members have been elected who come here thinking that government can't do good in our society and whose main goal is to prevent progress in government. And then that has the perhaps unintended consequence of further depressing people's interest in voting because they don't see that we're able to make progress. It's an unfortunate downward spiral.
You're looking for a Republican co-sponsor for your bill. Does that mean you go kind of knocking on people's doors and sitting down and talking with them and trying to convince them to co-sponsor this bill with you?
That's exactly right. Both in Selma and after the trip, I've met with a number of senators. I'm not yet done. There are some hopeful prospects. Some have been turned off by what they perceive as the partisanship of the discussion about voting rights. Others have been deeply moved by the weekend in Selma and are still reflecting on it and haven't made a final decision. Others just rejected the idea out of hand. And frankly, that's the hard work of being a legislator rather than a bomb thrower, of trying to work across the aisle, trying to build on friendships, trying to listen to what concerns they may have, what legitimate concerns they may have about the Voting Rights Act going forward. Look, there is no way to update and fix and strengthen the Voting Rights Act without the support of Republicans. I was raised in a Republican family that was proud of the traditions of the Republican Party, of fighting for abolition at its founding, of fighting for civil rights in the 60s. And I remind those with whom I speak that Republicans were always in the leadership of the civil rights movement in the last century, and it would be a great shame, a great loss of that history if they abandoned that role in this century.
And we're almost out of time here. What was it like for you to be in Selma? And were you even alive 50 years ago?
I was 2 years old when the march happened. My guest for the weekend was the new ambassador from South Africa, Ambassador Mahlangu. And as someone who I myself spent time in South Africa fighting apartheid with the South African Council of Churches, it was a powerful weekend to also see how Ambassador Mahlangu experienced it, heard it. And he and I had a great conversation with Congressman Lewis, who is a personally very inspiring leader in the civil rights movement, someone who marched across that bridge 50 years ago and faced the violence and the oppression and then has gone on to make an enormous difference. There was a powerful visual moment when that very bridge that he marched across was crossed back by a president, an African-American president, who delivered such a great and powerful speech.
Senator Chris Coons, thanks so much for joining us today on Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. He's a Democrat from Delaware. We'll be talking about Hillary Clinton's emails after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Earlier this week, Hillary Clinton held a news conference to explain why she used her private personal email account on her home server to conduct business when she was Secretary of State.
When I got to work as Secretary of State, I opted for convenience to use my personal email account, which was allowed by the State Department, because I thought it would be easier to carry just one device for my work and for my personal emails instead of two. Looking back, it would have been better if I simply used a second email account and carried a second phone, but at the time, this didn't seem like an issue.
Clinton revealed that she had turned over about 30,000 emails to the State Department and destroyed about the same number that were not connected with her work. She also said that what she did was permissible under government guidelines when she worked for the Obama administration. We asked Maggie Haberman to join us on Radio Times. She's presidential correspondent for the New York Times. And Maggie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. What you make of what Hillary Clinton said, the press coverage, much to discuss in this portion of Radio Times. To Maggie, and I was watching this on TV, and just sort of amazed, frankly, by the atmosphere, the frenzy at the news conference. Is that typical for a Hillary Rodham Clinton news event?
That there was such a frenzy?
Yeah.
I can't remember. I think the last time that there were that many reporters at a Hillary Rodham Clinton news event was, and if it was, I don't even think it was that many, was either when she declared her presidential campaign, and thinking back on it, it was an early Saturday morning, I think, in Manhattan in 2007, so it wasn't there, or it was when she declared her Senate candidacy in 1999 in New York. This was an unbelievable gathering. It was, you know, there was sort of nobody spearheading it in terms of calling on reporters and so forth. I think that Mrs. Clinton's allies believed at the end that they took some solace in, and this is something I've actually heard from people who just watched it on TV, that they thought that the frenzy of press, especially at the end with reporters shouting questions at each other, over each other to get heard, helped her to the extent that the press looked sort of over-eager and overly engaged. But, you know, she also did not stand there and wait until every question had been answered. It was not the kind of thing we saw Chris Christie do, you know, in New Jersey after the Bridgegate scandal developed more fully in January of last year. So this is a little different.
You know, I was going back and forth. Part of me felt like, you know, this is serious stuff. If a Secretary of State is using their personal email account to conduct business with world leaders during her tenure and in the administration. And you know, the other hand, I felt like, you know, there's nothing that Hillary Clinton can do or not do that doesn't get this intense kind of scrutiny. How do you sort of toggle back and forth between those two perspectives on her?
Look, you know, there is a kernel of truth in both, right? I mean, look, this is a very legitimate story. It is a very legitimate thing to write about. You know, her allies say overtly, and she sort of put implicitly that she doesn't really, you know, get the same level of fairness, you know, or she's held to a different standard than other people. She talked at her press conference about how, well, you know, I'm doing what basically other federal employees have done, and, you know, it's always at the discretion of the employee to figure out what to do. You know, so that is where you heard that argument. Mrs. Clinton has typically done pretty well politically when she's been seen as a victim. That is, I think, not a great place for her to begin her campaign this time, because where people are looking for, I believe, the next president is going to be some mix of, you know, keeping the best of Obama and then doing things differently. And to that extent, that's where her resume fits in well.
Well, and, you know, one wonders how difficult it would be to carry two smartphones, for instance. I'm sure she has people that would carry that second smartphone if it was inconvenient for her. Did that make sense to you?
Look, I don't know enough about the federal rules and when it may have changed, but certainly, most federal employees that I have seen over the last 8 years have carried two separate devices. I mean, that is just absolutely true, and that was the interpretation on the rules. There is no specific uniform rule governing email use and email capture at the different in the different worlds of government, right? So, I mean, the House, for instance, is not subject to the FOIA laws. It's a totally different thing. I think that the issue for what for her with what she said was the use of the word convenience.
Yes, which she used a number of times.
Number of times. That's not a great word. That's a word that suggests that I am, you know, I'm different. Or this was easier for me. Yes, other people did it this way, but this is how I did it. That's not a great way to be saying.
She also said, I thought it was interesting, said, you know, I basically trust the American people to decide what they think of this. She also seemed to be saying, you have to trust me that what I have done is all above board.
Yes. I mean, that is essentially her response. And that's never, look, when you're standing up there and your basic message is, I deleted 30,000 emails, but just trust me. Yeah. That's not a great message.
Is this the start of her presidential campaign, whether she likes
whether
it or
she
not?
Whether or not, no question about that.
Is that what we just witnessed this week?
She is now a candidate. I mean, this is not how she began her candidacy in a defensive crouch, and that's just not an ideal place to be.
That's Maggie Haberman. She's presidential correspondent for The New York Times. And we asked her to join us because one of the big stories this week was Hillary Clinton having a press conference, a news conference, to talk about a number of things, including the fact that she used a private personal email account from her home server when she was Secretary of State. And she had this press conference to explain what she did and why she did it and how she did it. And there was quite a press scrum there responding to her various explanations. We want to hear from you. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Do you think, Maggie, for some people, this is kind of a deja vu all over again when it comes to not just Hillary Clinton, but also Bill Clinton as well, which is it just seems like the personal and the political get tangled up and they're stuck in a situation having to explain themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is what often happens with them is, you know, a situation of their own making and then them feeling that they are getting either unfairly attacked or there's an overreach or so forth. I mean, and that is this was not a situation that is anybody's doing but Secretary Clinton. And so while I know the complaints are that the media has been unfair and so forth, she made a decision to do it this way, and then they made a decision to not address it for 8 days. So
are there questions from your perspective about what the Obama administration knew? I mean, whether they knew that she was conducting business this way, and she clearly had corresponded with the president.
Her team has done its best to try to distance her from the president from any knowledge of this. But remember, White House aides said that they knew that. I don't know what they knew in real time.
Mm-hmm.
The president said he was receiving emails from her with that email address, clintonemail.com. He just didn't think about it. And so he says, the White House, what was interesting to me is that the White House has said that they were alerted to this last August. And now, you saw the president say, I first learned about this issue from the news accounts, the news stories about this, which means that, you know, in the last 6 months, Hillary Clinton's team has not tried to get ahead of this. And it also means that nobody has tried to, with what the president is saying is true, that nobody told the president about it either. So it's very hard to know right now who was aware of what. We don't know whether she asked anybody for permission. We just have no idea.
As you mentioned, this is a sort of unofficial start of her presidential campaign. I was reading that she might make it more official in the next month or so. Do you mm-hmm. have any special knowledge of that, Maggie?
I believe she will be a candidate by the beginning of April. She's made a bunch of hires who are expected to begin their jobs in the final week of March. And I think that we will go mm-hmm. from there.
Any sort of sense of who she has as her team? I know that there were critics of her previous run for the president feeling as if the team that she had around her really weren't serving her particularly well.
She has a new, yes. I mean, there was certainly a frequent criticism of the staff, although I really think it is important to also bear in mind. I did a piece with my former colleague Glenn Thrush of Politico about this a year ago.
That's right.
She really dislikes the press, so it's not like... You know, it's not like she was inclined to come do a bunch of off-the-record chats with reporters and her team was saying, no, this is a terrible idea. I mean, this is her inclination, and the attitude towards reporters tended to follow, in a lot of cases, perhaps too closely. But the thing she prizes more than anything is somebody defending her, and that's what they were playing into. Whether she understands that it has to be different this time, I don't know. I know that the people that they are hiring are intended to signal that she understands that.
And does she dislike the press just because of her long history with the press?
Yeah, I think that most – I don't think that that's something that voters would give her a hard time about. Most people don't like the press, as we have discovered, being
yes.
the press. But she – look, she said something – she did a press conference in 1994 that this one has been compared – this last one has been compared to by a lot of people, including myself, called the Pink Press Conference, which was after the Whitewater land deal was being looked at. And there were reports that she had resisted a federal prosecutor an independent prosecutor looking into it. She sat and answered questions for over an hour in a very sort of measured way, which is not what happened here. But she had a line that I think is sort of a guiding principle for her, which is that I am essentially a private person living a public life. And I think that is how she sees it. I don't think that's realistic, but I think that is how she sees it.
I mean, certainly not if you're going to run for president or have run
right.
for president.
That's right. This is a constant theme for both Clintons with the media, is the push-pull of getting people to, sort of trying to draw up what she called in that very press conference a zone of privacy. She genuinely believes in it. That is something that she is going to continue to struggle with in this next campaign.
Let me see what Chris from Drexel has to say. Chris, go ahead. You're on Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So this borderlines on sort of like insane / ridiculous. Here's what I mean by that. So if the government itself, so the Secretary of State, does not have a unified email security policy, like every company in America that makes you sign off before you get your company address, that in and of itself is frightening. Secondly, we can't possibly imagine that world leaders or anybody in government would send any sensitive, confidential information to somebody at a Gmail account if they were the Secretary of State or Yahoo, right? So I don't know if we're making a much bigger deal of this than we need to. But my guess is there's either a total lack of email common sense security in terms of sensitive documents in our government, or everybody knows that if you're using a personal email address, you don't send certain types of information.
She has her own server, which may sort of complicate things a bit, Chris. But let me give Maggie Haberman a chance to respond, basically saying,
well, I don't know what the question is.
Well, I think part of the question is how, so much of the private business world has, all sorts of security when it comes to things like email. And how come in the government, the regulations seem so much looser than that?
Well, I don't know that the regulations are looser. I think there is a concern. This has been reported that the State Department server was hacked. I mean, so this is not the internet security in terms of the government is as much a concern as it is for private citizens.
Mm.
This has been an issue for a long time. One of the things that people were arguing when this story first came out, although this is not an argument that her team made, was that this must have been safer because the State Department wasn't secure. I mean, we just don't know. She
yeah.
said at the press conference that it was never hacked. I think that what the caller is saying is essentially, which is her argument, which is we should just take her at her word. And I don't think that is historically what happens in a democracy. Number one, but she has had issues with sort of how she is viewed in terms of, the do you trust this person question in public polling about a politician is not an insignificant one. And this is one that she has had issues with. But do I think that this is an issue that is going to be seminal in an election that is 19 months out? No, I do not.
We have an email message saying Hillary Clinton's choice of the word convenient, you mentioned that, Maggie, engenders a visceral revulsion and makes her seem dismissive. As a registered Democrat, I'm concerned about her candidacy and the outcome of the election. I mean, do you see maybe for some people on the fence that this was either a sort of a make or break press conference for her, as you said, 19 months before the election?
I think the Democrats felt like they needed to hear from her. I think that that's who she was talking to in that press conference. She was talking to
the Democratic
base. Yep.
What
a- and I think that they felt like they got enough. I think they don't understand. Once they heard what she had to say, I don't think they understood why she couldn't have said that 8 days earlier.
Mm.
But yes.
This is something else, but it has also come out having to do with the Clinton Foundation, the donations coming from Middle Eastern countries, some of these countries that have denied women basic, you know, rights to drive a car and to sort of operate their or live their life. Do you think that's going to be something that she's going to have to struggle with or try to explain?
I think there are going to be ongoing stories on that issue. I think it's something that Republicans have already made clear they're digging into. You know, Bill Clinton tried to address that last weekend when he was in Miami, literally saying, you know, I believe we do more good than harm. And, you know, that has often been the rationale from mm-hmm. people who support the Clintons is they do more good than harm. That does not, however, mean that the questions are not legitimate.
About a minute or so before we have to say goodbye here, but I mean, it's pretty clear she's going to run for president. Is it also pretty clear that she's going to have very few challengers in the Democratic Party?
I don't know that it's clear that she's going to have few challengers in the Democratic Party. I think there are people who are going to try to challenge her. I just think that they're going to have trouble getting traction in this environment.
And is that because she just takes up so much space?
She's just drowning out the oxygen. Taking up all the oxygen. I did a piece with two of my colleagues today, Nick Confessori and Jonathan Martin, just that, you know, yes, you can find a quote from somebody who's going to say, we're really scared, this is freaking us out. And Democrats privately are very worried about what happened last week. But she is it. She is, as a top Democratic mm-hmm. donor told us, the whole plan.
So it should be an interesting couple of months for you, Maggie yeah. Haberman.
For all of us, really.
For all of us, exactly. They care about politics.
Exactly.
Maggie Haberman, thank you very much for joining
thank
us today
you
in Radio
so much.
Times.
Take
and
care.
You too. And she's presidential correspondent for the New York Times, the second of three guests in this hour of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. We began our conversation talking with Delaware Senator Chris Coons about voting rights, and we have Suzanne Maloney waiting in the wings. And we'll be talking about this letter signed by 47 Republican senators to leaders in Iran about the negotiations going on having to do with Iran's nuclear program. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation with Suzanne Maloney, and also open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and this is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. 47 Republican senators signed an open letter to the leaders of the Islamic Republic of Iran this week, warning them that Congress or the next president could or would reverse the nuclear deal that's being negotiated. Freshman John Cotton, who authored the letter, has opposed the negotiations between Iran, the U.S., and its partners. Democrats expressed outrage. Senator Debbie Stabenow of Michigan, who opposed the Iraq war, said, "I never would have sent a letter to Saddam Hussein." Senator John McCain, one of the signers, admitted on Fox News maybe this wasn't exactly the best way to make a point. We asked Suzanne Maloney to join us, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Center for Middle East Policy, a former U.S. State Department policy advisor. She's got a new book coming out called Iran's Political Economy Since the Revolution. And Suzanne Maloney, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
Is this unprecedented, this letter that was sent out this week?
I think the letter itself is unprecedented. We've seen lots of freelancing on the part of congressmen and senators over the years when it comes to foreign policy issues, including many urgent issues involving the Middle East. What we've never seen is a group of senators from one party, the party that opposes the president, interceding in the midst of fairly sensitive negotiations that have been ongoing now for several years in a fashion that could conceivably create new complications on the road to getting an agreement.
Let me quote a couple of sentences from this letter. It begins, "It has come to our attention while observing your nuclear negotiations with our government that you may not fully understand our constitutional system." Do these leaders, people that are negotiating from Iran, do they need to be schooled in the U.S. Constitution?
Well, I have no doubt that they don't have as sophisticated an understanding of the U.S. political system as many of those who work on the Hill would have. But the reality is the letter was not intended to be helpful. The letter was very much aimed at trying to reinforce the paranoia of the Iranian regime about the durability of any commitments made by the Obama administration and about the inclination of the Republican Party, particularly those in the Senate, to try to undercut any deal that might be made. And really, the letter was sent with the intent of scuttling any progress toward a deal. And I think that there's, you know, very little doubt about that.
It ends, the next president could revoke such an executive agreement with the stroke of a pen, and future Congresses could modify the terms of the agreement at any time, basically saying, do you see that as this effort to scuttle the agreement or the negotiations?
Yeah. No, absolutely. This was, a sort of shot across the bow. And we've seen a number of prior open letters from congressmen and senators on this issue in the past. What we haven't seen is one that was directed toward the Iranian leadership. And I think the tone as well as the underlying points have contributed to some degeneration in the prospects of building trust with the Iranians and will likely prompt the Iranians to demand tougher terms, to demand more early sanctions relief in order to get as much as they can out of any deal prior to any change in administrations. And it could well, I think, reinforce some of the suspicions of the Iran supreme leader, who has been in some ways dead set against any kind of negotiation throughout this process in a way that's really detrimental to actually sealing a deal.
Does this sort of weirdly and paradoxically put these senators on the side of some of the hardliners in Iran who also oppose this deal?
Well, that was the Obama administration's argument. I take that with a bit of a grain of salt, because ultimately the Iranian negotiators wouldn't be at the table if they didn't have the support of the supreme leader, who is the ultimate decision maker on this issue. But obviously there's politics in Iran and there's a debate within that leadership about to what extent they should make concessions at the negotiating table. That's why this process has gone on so long. The Iranians have basically played hardball. And I don't think this letter helps with persuading them to give up more of their nuclear infrastructure or to rely on the commitments of the United States that if they in fact do make concessions, they will be rewarded with specific and conditional sanctions relief.
The senators are saying in this letter that because the president is pursuing an executive agreement with Iran rather than some kind of treaty, that would require a treaty that would require approval from the Senate. But the New York Times reported that something like 94% of the accords between the U.S. and other countries since the 1930s, so for almost 100 years, have been executive agreements.
Yeah, this is one of the sort of wrinkles to this whole issue, that there has been an ongoing struggle for turf between the Congress and the administration on this issue, in which the Congress has repeatedly attempted to assert some sort of decision-making authority over the validity of any deal that might be signed on the grounds that the Senate is constitutionally empowered to advise and consent on treaties. The administration has argued, and I think with some justification, that this is not going to be a treaty. It is a multilateral agreement that involves a number of other parties, and it is consistent with, as the New York Times report suggested, many agreements signed by prior administrations on all kinds of issues, including those that were contested by the other party that might have been in control of the Congress at the time. So the legality is really more of a fig leaf for the intent on the part of the Republicans in Congress to have a final say over our policy toward Iran.
But do you think this particular letter could derail or scuttle the negotiations?
I think it doesn't help matters. I mean, we heard from Iran's supreme leader overnight that, you know, this is more evidence of the deception and trickery of the United States. That is his, you know, sort of going in position. It's not as though it's changed his opinion. But given that he's the guy we've got to persuade in terms of making real concessions, it doesn't help us in building trust and in enabling him to rely upon the commitments of the United States.
From what you know about negotiations, and we don't know, at least certainly I don't know everything, does it seem like a deal that would at least temporarily prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons?
Well, you know, we've had a long struggle to get here, and it's really been since November 2013 that we've been working on trying to put together a formula for a comprehensive deal that would buy us time, effectively, put enough constraints on the Iranian nuclear program and provide enough transparency and verification of any arrangements that we would know that we had at least a year's time before Iran would have enough material to be able to build a nuclear weapon. And it appears that we are finally within reach of that formula. It's taken quite a bit of, I think, creative negotiating on the part of the United States and its partners from the permanent five members of the UN Security Council. But really, it's only been within the past couple of weeks that we've had this sense of confidence that it might, in fact, be a kind of 60-40 proposition that we're able to get there. And to have this letter come at the very moment where progress appeared to be within reach is, I think, particularly unfortunate.
Do you see a connection between this letter and Benjamin Netanyahu's speech last week before the joint session of Congress invited by Republicans in the House?
Oh, yeah, there's an absolute parallel, and I think this is part of a broader strategy to try to undercut the president's foreign policy on any number of issues. Iran is, of course, one of those issues that resonates more widely with the American people and one that certainly Republicans appreciate. They may have some ability to influence through these sorts of freelancing measures like inviting the prime minister to speak without informing the White House or dispatching this letter.
And that's Suzanne Maloney. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Center for Middle East Policy. And we asked her to join us on the show today to give us her reaction to the letter signed by 47 Republicans, an open letter sent to the leaders of the Islamic Republic of Iran this week, warning them that Congress or the next president could reverse the nuclear negotiations that are going on. And we want to hear from you, obviously, at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Suzanne, we have an email from Terry. I'd be curious about if you want to respond to this. He says, it reminds me of Republicans dodging legal channels in the Iran-Contra scandal to act in concert with Iranian hardliners. Do you see some parallels there?
I think there's analogies to be made. I don't think it's a direct parallel. That was, of course, a much broader conspiracy on the part of the Reagan administration. It was really aimed at funneling support to the Contras, the rebels in Central America. But it obviously involved a sort of back channel to the Iranians, which is precisely what we hear Republicans complaining about today in terms of the Obama administration's quiet efforts, even before the public diplomacy came to light, to try to build up some sort of an understanding with the Iranians that might lead to a resolution of this nuclear crisis.
We have a Facebook comment from William, and he says, could the letter to Tehran be considered a violation of the Logan Act? Some have raised that. Do you think it could?
I'm not a lawyer, which I think serves me well in speculating on these sorts of things. But from what I understand, the fact that it was an open letter, among many other factors, makes it unlikely that anyone would ever be prosecuted for this. It was, you know, it was not, in fact, delivered to the Iranian mission, to the United Nations or some other Iranian government office. And in reality, I don't believe the Logan Act is one that is frequently applied.
And what do you think the Republicans want? I mean, they obviously don't – they don't want this deal to go through. But is it that they want increased sanctions? Are they looking for a more military response to Iran?
I would be surprised if there was substantial support on Capitol Hill for any kind of use of force against Iran. I mean, ultimately, we've seen in crises past, including Syria, that despite tough talk from the Congress, there is a disinclination to engage America in another war in the Middle East. And that reflects, obviously, public opinion across the country. What Republicans and some Democrats on the Hill have said in criticism of the Obama administration's efforts to negotiate with Iran is really twofold. One, that they've given away too much already. They've made substantial concessions to the Iranians, including an implicit acknowledgement of Iran's right to enrich uranium, which is provided in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, but has been contested by many. And the other issue is simply that making a deal with Iran that provides any concessions or any sanctions relief to Iran at this time, when Iran appears to be expanding its influence across the Middle East in a variety of places, from Iraq to Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen, is a dangerous deal. And so I think it's those two factors that really unnerve many Republicans and some Democrats.
And the fact that the U.S. and Iran is fighting ISIS, or at least on the same side, seeing ISIS as a threat, does that also complicate either negotiations or geopolitical situations in the Middle East?
Yeah, it's an enormous complication. I mean, we have similar interests in trying to fight off ISIS. ISIS is a group that is inimical to Iran as a Shia state and as, of course, the one sort of Islamic republic in the region. And Iran has been deeply involved in the campaign to beat off ISIS in Iraq. It's Iranian commanders who are directing the efforts of Shia militias around Iraq and to try to retake Tikrit, for example, at this very moment. We would like to see those efforts succeed, but there is, I think, very deep concern, as we heard yesterday in testimony from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, about the expectation that Iran's efforts are likely to only deepen sectarianism in the region and could well lead to an entrenchment of a conflict even well after we're able to defeat ISIS. So, you know, these factors absolutely complicate all of our politics in the region.
And how much hardship have the sanctions created in Iran?
Sanctions have been enormously effective in terms of impacting the bottom line of the government, but also in terms of its reach into the pocketbooks of ordinary Iranians, particularly over the course of the past 5 years, as sanctions have become directed at Iran's financial sector and even at its oil sector. Its oil exports initially dropped by as much as half of their prior levels, and the currency also crashed within a matter of weeks, lost nearly half its value back in early 2012. Iran has been able to rebound a little bit, partly as a result of the interim nuclear agreement, which provided some limited sanctions relief, also partly as a result of the better management of the economy by the president who was elected in June 2013, Hassan Rouhani. But really, Iran desperately needs to be let back into the community of nations to be able to do business as usual with the rest of the world in a way that's simply still not possible today. And for that reason, I think, you know, they're very much focused on that as the outcome of the talks.
Do you see, as you look into your crystal ball into the future, let's say the next 10 years, it seems that negotiators are kind of banking on this, which is that Iran will moderate in its politics? Do you see that?
I'm actually very supportive of a deal that provides us with the appropriate assurances on Iran's nuclear program. I don't think it's axiomatic that Iran then necessarily moderates. We've seen, in fact, repeated efforts over the years on the part of different groups and individuals in Iran to try to moderate various aspects of the policy. And unfortunately, hardliners have the upper edge in Iran and retain that. And they have a sort of transactional approach to foreign policy, which means we're going to, you know, I think it's quite possible to see concessions on the nuclear issue that won't translate into a kinder, gentler Iran around the region or an Iran that treats its own population better than it does today.
Final question. Do they want a bomb?
Well, I think almost any rational government that lives in the place that Iran lives, that has had the kind of experience with invasion from its own neighbor, as well as constant perception of efforts by the rest of the world to undercut the regime, that lives in a region where there are a number of other nuclear powers, would certainly be engaged in the kind of pursuit of nuclear weapons capability. And I think that that is the almost incontrovertible conclusion that one draws from looking at the extent of the program, the investment that they've made in the program. What we don't know for sure is whether Iran, in fact, would be prepared to build a bomb, to weaponize. And I think that, you know, is something with a decision we'd like to put off for as long as possible.
Suzanne Maloney, thanks so much for joining us today on the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Center for Middle East Policy, a former U.S. State Department policy advisor, and her new book is called Iran's Political Economy Since the Revolution, the third of three guests in this edition of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the program, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter, and how to find us also on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.